The following announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
Hey, welcome to another edition of the Filthy FRB Show for Monday, March 4th. I'm FRB, and of course I'm joined by Filthy Tom Lawler. What's going on, Tom?
Not too much. Same old shit.
Yeah. Toilet. Right. Well, we're going to try a little bit different format today. Basically, it was inspired by the Lapsed Fan Podcast, which I think is on WrestleZone.com, and it's hosted by Jack Encarnacion and another gentleman who – do you know who the co-host is?
Nope.
Okay. Well, basically, they go back and they look at old WWE – pay-per-views, and they kind of talk about them and, you know, kind of put into context what the matches meant at the time and just kind of bring you back in time. So Tom and I on this show are going to do the same for UFC 100, which happened July 11th, 2009 in Las Vegas. And what makes this really interesting is there's only 22 fighters who can stake claim to being on UFC 100, one of the biggest MMA cards there's ever been. And I'm talking to one of them right now. So other than him, there's only 21 guys out there who can make the same claim. And there's only two other guys, I think, who can say they got a bonus at this event. You got quite a bonus there, Tom.
Well, it would be three other guys.
Three other guys, okay. But that was a pretty good night for you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. as far as careers go, that would probably be the most important night I've had so far. You know, if you're going to judge success based on money, so getting that submission of the night against CB Dalloway was a big time factor in my life for sure. And I'm still kind of like living off a little bit of that money as we speak.
Yeah. So up until that point, $100,000 bonus I think was the most the UFC had ever disclosed. You know, we've heard the stories about the locker room bonuses, which were considerably more than 100,000. But up until that point, I think that was the largest disclosed bonus they'd ever given out.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the case as well. I remember being in the, for those of you that don't know, at UFC events, after the weigh-ins, you go into this, like a secluded room in the area, all the fighters. And then Dana White comes in, or Lorenzo, or Joe Silva, or somebody comes in, and they break it down for you and tell you how much the bonuses are going to be for each fight, or for each event. And when Dana came back, I think it was Dana and Joe Silva came back, and they said $100,000. It was like, whoa, kind of jumps out at you. And I was fortunate enough to win that one, and you know. Little known fact here is that there was a deal in place between myself and Chris Palmquist, who is one of the owners of the Underground, mixedmartialarts.com, that if I won the bonus, one of the bonuses, that he would purchase two transsexual hookers to hang out with us for the night. Just to hang out with us. Not, you know, we weren't going to do anything, but he was going to hire them for us to party with.
You know, your kids could be listening to this maybe in like whatever they come along. You ever think about that?
Yep. Hey, whatever. No regrets.
Yeah. Well, before we get into your fight, the first fight of the night was Shannon Guggerty, who fought out of San Diego. He was 27 at the time. He was 11-3 in MMA. He's since retired. I don't think he's fought since 2012. And he took on Matt Grice, who at the time was also 27 years old and had a 10-2 record. What's your recollection of that matchup? I guess you were in the back during the curtain jerk, or you probably couldn't really watch.
Yeah, I remember more about the guys themselves than I do the actual fight. I just know that Shannon Guggerty won by guillotine choke.
So did that get you nervous a little bit right before you're about to make the walk? If this guy gets a submission, you're like, oh, shit, you know, that $100,000 bonus, and this guy's already, you know, set the bar.
No, not at all. To be honest, I've never, like, going into a fight, I've never been paying attention to the bonuses. You know, I'm solely focused on winning the fight first. And the bonuses will come, you know. That's the way that it is, Brian.
All right. So the second fight, of course, you know, we already touched upon it a little bit. But take us back a little bit, because at the time you were 26 years old and you were relatively inexperienced for a UFC fighter at the time. You came in, you only had 6 fights. Mm-hmm. I guess a couple more on the show, on the Team Nogueira versus Team Mir that don't count officially.
Yeah.
But take us back to your preparation for Dalloway, and you know, everybody knows his wrestling background at Arizona State, and people are kind of high on him. They thought he would have a good future, which he has. He's accomplished a pretty good amount in the UFC. But take us back to your preparation, and what did you think about Dalloway going into the fight?
I just trained my ass off, basically. I trained a lot, probably far too much in retrospect. But, you know, I got the outcome that I wanted, and, you know, obviously by winning the fight. To be honest, at that time, myself and Seth Petruzzelli and another guy, Mike Lee, had just recently opened up a new facility, the Jungle MMA in Orlando. So a lot of my time was just spent in the gym, you know, teaching classes and training during those classes, and also training during the other classes that were going on at the gym at that time, and sparring a few times a week. So, you know, I was probably training, you know, over or close to 20 hours a week in preparation for that fight, just because I had to be at the gym all day anyway. So that's pretty much what I remember from the preparation for that. I do remember also, okay, so we're in the back, and there's some other stories I'll tell from the locker room in a while, but right before the fight, my corner man, Mike Lee, says, "Well, we're working, we're warming up, going over submissions," and I slap on a guillotine, and after I let go, he looks at me and he goes, "Okay, don't go for the guillotine, like, unless you know you have it for sure." So, of course, the first thing that happens in the fight, you walk out and CB Dalloway throws a punch and then shoots right into a guillotine. So, you know, basically my corner man told me not to do the move that won me the fight and won me $100,000.
Yeah. So he really earned his keep that night, huh?
Yeah. Between that and I have a disqualification loss on my record because Seth Petruzzelli told me to knee the head of a downed opponent. You know, those two are not two of the better cornering jobs I've seen.
Yeah, he always seems to be causing problems. He killed a promotion single-handedly, and he caused you to get disqualified. Always causing problems. But, what, you know, you had fought the prior December 2008, you had fought your now good friend Kyle Kingsbury at the Tough Finale in Las Vegas, which I was actually there. I didn't know you at the time, but I was drinking quite heavily with Stanky. I think I have told this story on the show before, but Stanky had been thrown out of the Pearl at the Palms like 4 or 5 times, and he kept getting back in because he had this like gym bag, and it kind of looked like he was supposed to be there, but apparently he'd been drinking all goddamn day.
Well, he was supposed to be there, sure. He was one of the assistant coaches on the show. I'm sure he was supposed to be there. I don't think he was supposed to be, you know, 3 sheets to the wind and shit-faced. That was probably the issue.
Yeah, and he kept going, saying, ask Nogueira, I'm supposed to be here. Nogueira's like, you know, he kind of gave that, like, I don't understand anything you're saying. And I guarantee Nogueira understands, at that point, understood a little English.
Oh, for sure.
So the reason I bring up your previous fight, that was in December 2008, and of course UFC 100 was July 11th.
Yeah.
What was the reason for the long layoff, and did you have to work or politic a little bit to say, hey, get me on the biggest UFC card ever, really?
No, absolutely not. Basically, that was like the first fight that was offered to me, and it was offered to me, I seem to remember, like really like 4 or 5 months out. It seemed like they had set that show. So there was a period, and that actually happened with my next fight after that fight with Aaron Simpson. it just so happened to be that there was a 6 month period between the fights. It wasn't me being injured or not looking for a fight. It just so happened that's the way the matchups and cards fell.
Yeah, and you know, I hope this doesn't kill the thunder for the main event, but you know, Lesnar and Mir 2 was not supposed to be on this card. It was actually supposed to main event UFC 98, which was 6 weeks earlier. So Frank Mir hurt his knee. So the fight got moved to UFC 100, and all of a sudden you got this triple main event, and this, you know, very historic MMA event just kind of happened by accident. Because the best as I know, like even talking to Dan Henderson, he was supposed to be the co-main with GSP headlining. Him and Bisping were supposed to be co-main. Yeah. At least that's what they told him. And then when Mir got injured, that fight got moved to 100, and it cost Dan some money.
Yeah, well, Dan and Bisping was a big deal at the time, coming off of the Ultimate Fighter. I think it was season, I guess it was season 9, maybe?
Yeah, it was right after the one you were on, 8. So
yeah. Yep, so they were coming off of that season, and they had a lot of momentum behind that. So that was a big-time matchup. Big-time matchup there. And actually, I think it was the night before. Fuck. I'm not going to be able to remember what movie it was that I went to see, but Bisping was in the theater as well, and him and his crew were loud as shit and annoying.
Yeah.
Talking the whole movie, man. The entire time.
So the next fight was Stun Gun Kim versus TJ Grant. So coming into this fight, Stun Gun Kim was 11-0-1. He's 27 years old. TJ Grant was 14-2, 25 years old at the time. And just to set this up for you, Stun Gun Kim had beaten Jason Tan. He had won at UFC 88 against the immortal Matt Brown in a very controversial decision. And then his next fight, UFC 94, was against Carl Parisian that Carl actually won. And then it got overturned to and made a no contest because Carl had enough painkillers to get the entire city of Los Angeles high in his system. And TJ Grant, young guy back at the time.
Brian, are you sure about that? I think there's a lot of junkies in L.A. I mean, come on.
It was quite a bit. But he had a whole bunch of stuff.
The entire city?
Yeah. Or maybe the entire city of Glendale, which is known to be the home of many Armenians.
Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah. So, if we weren't trying to stay on topic, I'd talk about this Armenian genocide thing. But
The Kardashians are after Obama to chastise the Turkish government, but the Turks are an ally of ours, so we won't.
I was just in Turkey not too long ago.
It wasn't USO, it was something else, right?
Yeah. Armed Forces Entertainment.
Armed Forces, yeah, sure. So TJ Grant was this was his second fight. He had beat Rio Chonin. And then he has this fight against Stun Gun Kim. I don't think there was really much to it. You know, Stun Gun won by decision. Do you remember anything from it? Or
nah, I think he just kind of took him down and controlled him from what I remember. You know, it wasn't a bad fight. I'm trying to remember because in the back, you know, I was kind of happy and I'm getting my wraps cut and all that shit. So, but I seem to remember, you know, Stun Gun kind of just controlling him. And that seems to be his MO in most of his fights anyway. So,
yeah, that was his reputation that's kind of carried him, you know, even to the present day. He just kind of takes you down and has a strong top game. And that's basically been the hallmark of his career. Next matchup was a 25-year-old Jim Miller, who was 13-2 at the time. He was a somewhat recent addition from the IFL. Probably about a year he had come over from the IFL, and he defeated Mac Danzig, at the time was 29 years old, and had an 18-6 record, and probably had fought in every promotion known to man, including Pride. You remember anything interesting about this one?
No, my memory is probably going to start getting hazy pretty soon.
Because you were drinking that night?
Yeah, when it comes to some of these fights, yeah. I managed to sneak off after a little bit, and head up to the room and get some clothes and then head back down to the arena. But I think this fight might have been the one that I missed completely.
Yeah, and just to give everybody a little bit of context, Miller came into the fight. He was coming off a loss to Gray Maynard at UFC 96 in Columbus. Prior to that, he had beaten David Baron and Matt Wyman. Danzig was coming off two losses, Clay Guida and Josh Neer. So just to provide a little bit of context for you on that one.
Hey, are my dogs going nuts?
He's going nuts, yeah.
Is it like too loud?
Yeah, well, I mean, I can hear it. I don't know. I'll try to work through it.
Hey! Oh, fuck.
We don't do any editing on this show, so people are just going to have to go with it. You know, we don't.
Let's go. We got open air time. Go, run with it.
Okay, well, the next fight is actually a very historically significant fight. You know, at the time, in 2009, a 21-year-old phenom who was only 8-0 at the time, only had 8 fights, he had only been fighting for a little bit over 2 years, I think, at the time. 21 years old. His name is John Jones. And he was fighting Irish Jake O'Brien, who was coming down from the heavyweight division where he had lost a couple fights. You know, he had lost to Cain Velasquez.
He had beaten Andre Arlovsky, though.
No, he lost that fight.
To Arlovsky?
Yeah, so he lost to Arlovsky, lost to Cain, then beat Christian Wellish, and then this was his first fight at the 205 division.
Oh, okay.
So just to put into context, you know, Jones. Yeah, man, that dog's pissed off.
No, he's just alive. That's how he is. Is there can you edit this? Can you edit this show?
Yeah, we can edit it.
Oh my fucking god!
Yeah, how do you calm him down? You gotta give him a.
I'm gonna fucking beat him.
All right, so I'll just talk aimlessly here a little bit, and
that's who.
While Tom takes care of the dog, I mean, I remember John Jones. I was at UFC 87 in Minneapolis, which was headlined by GSP and John Fitch, and then also Brock Lesnar and Heath Herring. And also Roger Huerta and Kenny Florian was on that card. But I remember I was sitting, you know, a couple rows behind Jesse the Body Ventura and Adrian Peterson. And man, that place was packed. And it was this guy, Andre Guzman. I don't know exactly how you say it, but at the time, he was a really hot prospect. People were talking about him a lot as a guy who could make some noise at 205 pounds. And, you know, I see this John Jones guy, and I didn't know who he was. I don't think anybody knew who he was. He was just, you know, fighting on some local shows in New York and just killing people. And so I just watched the fight, and, you know, he didn't finish him. You know, it went to a decision. But I was like, you know, that kid, because what stood out to me was I believe John had just turned 20, or he was 19 and was going to turn 20. Well, let's see here. 20. No, I think he was 20. So I was just like, wow, this is a young kid. And, you know, not to make any jokes. He was an incredibly gifted athlete at the time. And you could just see, oh, you know, maybe this guy's going to be really good in a few years. I mean, I never thought he'd become the best fighter to ever do this, but it was pretty apparent by seeing him that night that there was something special there. And then after that, he got another fight at UFC 94 against Stephen Bonner. And believe it or not, John Jones was a somewhat considerable underdog to Bonner. He was at plus 160. That's what I betted at the MGM Grand Sportsbook right before UFC 94, which of course was headlined by GSP and BJ Penn. And again, he didn't finish Bonner, but you know, he did that very memorable spinning back elbow that kind of clipped Bonner behind the head. But Bonner actually won one of those rounds. So it wasn't like Jones was a completely finished product at the time, but you could see like this guy was there's something there. And Jake O'Brien, you know, he was at the time a young guy too. He was only 24 at UFC 100. So I think Joe Silva said, hey, you know, we got Jake O'Brien coming down from heavyweight. You know, he might have a future in this thing. We got John Jones, 21-year-old, coming off a couple nice wins in the UFC against, you know, one really good prospect and then one rugged veteran. And so they did the match, and John just ran through him. And John did some kind of modified guillotine. I don't even know what it's called. Hey, Tom, are you back? I guess that's a no. So it was some kind of modified guillotine. I don't know if it was a 10-finger guillotine. I'd have to watch the tape again. But it was just a really dominant performance. And you could just see, you know, that was when you would look at John and say, you know, in 2 years, I can see that guy at the top of the division, maybe becoming a world champion. So they did that fight, of course. And then the next one up was a fight that I emotionally was really invested in because Mark Coleman was fighting Stephen Bonner. Mark Coleman was 44 years old at the time.
And all right, I got rid of those fuckers.
All right. So I just talked about John Jones for way too long.
Yeah.
Just to kind of give maybe some of the newer fans some context of John's first few fights and what people thought of him. And I just kind of went through what I witnessed. I was at UFC 87 when he made his debut. I remembered that performance when he came to fight at UFC 94. I saw he was an underdog against Stephen Bonner. I threw some money on him. What at this point in time, coming into UFC 100, what did you know about John Jones? What were the guys in the back saying about this 21-year-old kid from New York?
Well, pretty much everybody knew he was super talented right off the bat. My last fight before fighting in the UFC, so my last fight that I've had ever outside of the UFC was on a show that John Jones made his pro debut on as well. So I saw him fight there. It was only, you know, a short minute or two fight. So I saw him fight there. And we actually spoke about that in the back of the locker room. You know, he had said like, hey, I fought on that show. You know, so then we were looking at you, we were watching you, scouting you, because we thought that, you know, we'd eventually fight you. But then, you know, obviously he got called up to the UFC pretty soon after making his debut. And when you're, you know, I think when he beat Stephen Bonner, that was his second fight into the UFC. I think he beat Andre Guzmão the first time, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So when you beat Stephen Bonner in your second fight in the UFC, you know, the guy's a veteran, big-time name. You know, obviously there's big things in the future for you. So everybody knew he was super talented.
Now, was he with Jackson's yet?
Or
was
no.
He still Bomb Squad?
Yeah, he was in New York. I don't know exactly what his training situation was, but I remember he had a Indian/Native American fellow in his corner. And, you know, me and my corner guys and, you know.
Was it Tatanka?
No, may have been Chief J Strongboat.
Okay, all right.
So we're, you know, we're in the back and we're like, oh man, you know, John Jones does all this cool spinning stuff, and watching him hit mitts is going to be crazy because he was in the same locker room as me. And so the guy, you know, they're getting ready to warm up. Guy grabs the mitts, gets ready. We're like, oh, this is going to be good. And he's like, one. It was like throwing one punch at a time the entire time. We thought John Jones was going to put on this awesome display in the back, and instead he hit mitts like, you know, the most basic combinations I've ever seen in my life. But hey, he went out there and tore it up in the cage. So.
Yeah, because, you know, while you were away there, I was, you know, Jake O'Brien was only 24 at the time, and he had won some decent fights at heavyweight, and he was coming down. I think this was his first fight at light heavyweight. And there were some hopes that Jake O'Brien could become something in the division.
From who? His family?
I thought amongst the fans, I thought that he was a respectable fighter.
Yeah, respectable, but I thought that he was being fed to John Jones because Jake O'Brien was basically regarded as a boring fighter.
Gotcha. So the next fight was a fight, you know, I was just getting into it when he came back, but Mark Coleman versus Stephen Bonner. Mark Coleman was about a 4-1 underdog. So Coleman was coming into the fight. He was 44 at the time, and he was coming off. He hadn't been very active. He was coming off a loss to Fedor at Pride in Vegas. Then he got signed to the UFC, and he was supposed to fight Lesnar at UFC 87. And then hurt his knee, didn't compete.
Can you imagine what that fight would have been like? Jesus.
And you know, there was people, I remember, on the Underground and on Sheredog saying, oh, they're throwing Lesnar to the wolves. I mean, you know, Coleman's an Olympic wrestler. And it's like, he's 44 years old. Lesnar, you know, but Coleman was coming off that epic fight. No matter which way you look at it, both guys were gassed 60 seconds into the fight against Shogun, UFC 93 in Dublin, Ireland, which there was a young guy named Conor McGregor who was there in the stands as a fan taking a picture with Chuck Liddell. I don't know if you've seen that one going around the internet.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, so Coleman was coming off that fight, and it was kind of like, well, you know, I mean, Bonner was coming off a loss. No, actually, he was coming off two wins, Mike Nichols and Eric Schaefer, but prior to that, he was suspended for a while because he lost to Forrest Griffin for the second time and then tested positive for an anabolic substance. So Bonner was the big favorite. What were your thoughts going into the fight, Tom?
Actually, it pretty much played out like how I thought it was going to. You know, from what I remember, Coleman just got on top and rode him out for three rounds, right?
You know, I would have to go back. I could have sworn that Bonner might have won the first round. And then at the start of the second round, Coleman caught him. Bonner did something really stupid. And then Coleman was able to get him down and then busted him open. And then I think he took the second and third round. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I mean, that could have been the case. You know.
Yeah.
We are looking at years and years ago, but yeah, you know, it sounds, you know, obviously Coleman's best chance was controlling Bonner on the ground and getting him down. And Bonner's best chance was on the feet, so.
And that was a pretty historic fight for Coleman because it was his second to last fight as an MMA fighter. He only fought one more time against Randy Couture. He was supposed to fight Tito and injured his knee at UFC 106, and then they threw him back in there the following February against Randy, and Randy just went through him like he was nothing.
Yeah, Randy tore him apart, and you know, Coleman was kind of looking old. You know, definitely in that Shogun fight and past that, and really for a few years. Even if you go back to his win in the Pride Grand Prix, you know, he was considered past his prime at that point. So, and that was the year 2000.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, he was done.
Yeah, so that was viewed as a big upset when he won the Pride Grand Prix. It was like he came back out of nowhere from the depths of despair after being heel-hooked by Nobuhiko Takada.
You know, he's I think he's actually come out, or hopefully I'm not getting him in trouble or anything, but he's told people, he's like, hey, I had some bills to pay. I did it. You know, I'm not like the most proud about it, but the price was right.
Yeah. I think everybody knows what the deal is with that fight, that it was a 100% shoot.
100% shoot?
Yeah. Yeah.
Takada's that good, huh?
Hey, man. He's, you know, well-trained. A well-trained athlete. I believe he was, who was he trained by? Fujiwara?
Yeah, the UWFI, right?
Yeah, so there you go.
So now we transition to the main card, which featured the debut, as Chiavello says. I don't know which is the right way. I say debut. But Yoshihiro Akiyama making his UFC debut. And Akiyama at the time was 33 years old. He was 12-1-2, taking on Alan Belcher, who was 25 at the time and was 14-5. So he really started fighting early. Mm-hmm. And just to provide some context, Akiyama, he was in the Dream Promotion. He had fought Shibata and Tanuka. You know, he had beaten both of those. But the fight previous to that...
Was that the Orient Express?
Now...
Back to back?
The Orient Express was Saito and Tanaka?
I believe so.
And didn't they have a manager? Oh, yeah, Mr. Fuji.
The new Orient Express was who? Who was in that?
Oh, you got me on that one.
I believe it was Paul Diamond.
Oh, yeah, under a mask with...
Yeah.
Was there a guy, Pat Tanaka, right? That's...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. All right. Anyways.
Yeah. But
I digress.
Yeah. But before that, you know, what happened? It was New Year's Eve 2007. I think it was a Yaranoka event where Fedor fought the giant from Korea.
Hangman Choi?
Yeah, Hangman Choi. Now, it was... So, Akiyama fought Kaz Misaki, and it was at first ruled a KO win for Misaki, but then they said that the kick was illegal. Do you remember that fight?
Yeah. I do, but I would have to go back and... That finish. I usually, when it goes back to Dream, I focus more on the... you know, the dirty laundry, soap incident that he had with his gi, with Sakuraba.
Yeah, I was gonna get to that. What was so interesting though about the Misaki fight was it was changed to a no contest. It's like, well, if it was an illegal kick, that's a fucking DQ. Why is it a no contest?
Oh, wait a minute. You know what it was? Okay.
And Sakuraba was a no contest also, even though that should have been a DQ because they said he was greasing.
I think in the because it was like basically like a K-1 or a Dream against a Pride fighter, right?
It might have been Heroes, the 2006 incident with Sakuraba.
No, I'm thinking with the one with Misaki.
Okay, I think that was Yaranoka, the old executives from Dream Stage threw that event together at the last minute.
Yeah, I think it may be in that fight there were no kicks on the ground.
Yeah.
Yes. But from what I remember, Misaki had just knocked him down, like clean out already, and I don't think the kick was very necessary.
Yeah, so basically Misaki deserved to win.
Yeah, even though
and maybe they're just trying to change face, save face, because Akiyama was their big star. But the Sakuraba Greasegate, which was, I don't know, 2 years before Greasegate stateside here between BJ and GSP at UFC 94, that really made Akiyama out to be this incredible heel in Japan, because Akiyama comes from Korean extraction. He's Korean and Japanese. And from what I understand, the Japanese don't like the Koreans.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of problems between the two of them, judging back, you know, thousands and thousands of years with, you know, occupation by the Japanese in South Korea. So, they're still kind of, you know, at war with each other. And it makes it interesting that, you know, pretty much the biggest figure in Japanese pro wrestling, Riki Dozen, was South Korean, you know?
Yeah, so the selective outrage. But Alan Belcher, coming into this, had beaten Ed Herman and also Dennis Kang. And, you know, go back to 2009, Dennis Kang was a pretty solid win.
Yeah, oh yeah, Dennis Kang was great at the time. You know, he's a name that a lot of guys forget nowadays, but for a while, especially in the early 2000s, he was on a roll, and he was killing it overseas, and then it kind of fell off. His career went in some pretty interesting waves. You know, he was not doing so great at first, you know, kind of 50-50, then all of a sudden he was one of the top guys in the world for a few years, and then kind of dropped off again. But he was, you know, at the top of his game around that time.
Yeah, he also had some personal problems. You know, I've heard a lot of people say the guy was just never the same after his girlfriend at the time, Shelby Walker, passed away very young.
Yeah.
I think a fiance, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And Brian, just to go back and clarify, yeah, that so there was no kicks on the ground in the Masaki Akiyama fight. And at first, they just ruled it a KO win for Masaki.
Okay.
Then they went back and changed it.
Gotcha. So this was an incredibly controversial fight, Akiyama and Belcher. Mm. Akiyama got the decision win. A lot of people thought Belcher won. I was in the audience. I mean, you know, live, I thought maybe Akiyama edged it, but I think I had also bet on him, so I was probably just seeing what I wanted to see. Did you get to rewatch it, or did you just watch it live? Or
I remember watching it live, and I thought it was a great fight, back and forth, real close. I thought that Belcher, you know, squeaked it out, but you know, I could see how you could score for Akiyama as well, especially, you know, the judges aren't seeing the same thing that everybody in the crowd sees, and they don't see the same thing that the people at television, you know, watch on television see. So they had different vantage points, and maybe they're seeing stuff that, you know, we're not seeing. So I wasn't surprised that it was a decision for Akiyama.
I think the judges were mesmerized by Akiyama's walkout, the great time to say goodbye walkout, which I don't maybe 10% of the people in the audience there at UFC 100 actually got it. It wasn't like a new gimmick for them.
No, but you know, I think ever since the inclusion of that song in the movie Step Brothers, there's been a big increase in notoriety for that song. So,
yeah. So, other than it being a good fight and getting the fight of the night and getting $100,000 apiece, I'm sure that made it a lot more manageable to deal with for Alan Belcher, for, you know, getting the perceived short end of the stick from the judges.
Yeah.
But so, the next fight that was supposed to happen was Fitch and Paulo Thiago. Do you want to actually do it in the order that they happened, or do you want to talk about this one now?
No, nah, let's go in the order that it happened.
That it actually happened. Okay, so then we'll go to Dan Henderson versus Michael Bisping, who were coming off their time as opposing coaches on Tough 9. And at this point in history, Dan Henderson was 38 years old. He had a 24-7 record, and he was coming off. He was coming off two wins. He had beaten Pelharis, UFC 88, and then he had a somewhat controversial victory over Rich Franklin at UFC 93 in Dublin to get the spot on The Ultimate Fighter. It was either him or Franklin, whoever won, got it. And Bisping at the time, believe it or not, was 17-1. And his only loss was at UFC 78 to Rashad Evans. And this was his fourth fight at middleweight. And he was undefeated. I mean, he had beaten Charles McCarthy, Jason Day, and Chris Leben. Not a murderer's row, but three capable guys. So he was...
Are you sure none of those guys have murdered somebody?
I don't know. You never know with Leben. I mean, if there's somebody who could get away with it, it's Leben.
Yeah.
So, you know, so Hendo and Bisping, and this is kind of like, this is, you know, one of those things that, like, people are like, oh, they really don't like you. You know, it's all fake. It's just for the cameras. You know, Dan is a pretty easy guy to get along with. He's just kind of very low key and, you know, he doesn't really get upset. You know, he's just a really nice, regular guy.
Yeah.
But Bisping pisses him off. And, you know, it's not like he doesn't like Bisping to this day, but even after this, like, they've been around each other and, you know, they've had some words.
Yeah, I could definitely see how those two are very different, you know, different personalities would clash, because those two are absolutely nothing alike.
Yeah, like I said, Dan is kind of low key, and Bisping's got a big mouth and, and likes to stir the pot a little bit.
Dan likes to wear the American flag, you know. Bisping's like, you know, the perfect British foil. It's great. This is a rivalry that should just continue on.
This rivalry
should always be going on.
You know, I actually asked Dan about this when I saw him at the NCAA Wrestling Championships about 6 weeks ago, whenever the hell it was.
Yeah.
I asked him, I was like, hey, do you think you fight Bisping again? And he's like, you know how Dan talks, like, I'm not giving that guy a rematch. He doesn't deserve one. Why? You know, so he's still a little upset with Bisping. He's like, no, I'm not giving it. He doesn't deserve it.
Yeah.
But, you know, interesting that this kind of gets swept under the rug. A month before it had come out, it had been announced by the UFC. I don't know if it came directly from Dana, but the winner of this fight was supposed to get a middleweight title shot against Anderson Silva.
Yeah.
And it never happened, which was one of the reasons why Dan said, well, forget this. I'm going to Strikeforce, which opened up the number one contenders match against Nate Marquardt for Chael Sonnen. And so Dan leaving was the only reason why Chael was able to get in that number one contenders fight.
Yeah. Were they in cahoots, Brian?
I don't know. I mean, Strikeforce offered him $800,000 a fight. And yeah. UFC, I think, was like at maybe like half that or less. So I think it was just Showtime and Scott Coker had just come up with so much money that Hendo couldn't say no, and the UFC wasn't going to match.
Yeah, they treated him really well.
Oh yeah, I think in 1 year he banked. I think it was a 4-fight deal, right? Shields, Babalu, Fedor, and Feijão.
I was in the corner for Feijão.
In Dan's corner.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, you were out there.
Oh, I'm out there.
Yeah.
I'm way out there, Brian.
So he banked over $3 million in 1 year from Strikeforce.
I thought you said he banged over. I was like, where's this going?
No.
Airing this kind of stuff on, you know.
He's a married man now.
Yeah.
His wife is very nice. I got to meet her in St. Louis. I think her name is Rachel, but you know, I was indulging in some drinks, so that names kind of, you know, they kind of come in one ear and out the other. But so basically, this fight is history will show that you know, one of the greatest, or perhaps the greatest, single knockout in UFC history.
Yeah, this one is. And it deserves to be on every single highlight reel in the future. Every time they play Bob O'Reilly at the stadium or at the arena, this should be on it. Every time they have a UFC commercial, this knockout should be on it. Every time you close your eyes and you think about a fight, this knockout should be in it, you know, along with my knockout of Jason McDonald. But, this one's an all-time great knockout.
For sure.
For sure.
So, do you have anything else on Hendo and Bisping, or just move to the next bout?
No, well, I do remember. I'm in the stands at this point, watching the fights from the bleachers, and I think it was maybe Bisping's brother-in-law, perhaps. I think is in the seats, because usually when they give out the tickets to the fighters, the seats are all in the similar section.
Yeah.
Now, so you're sitting with like other family members or, you know, whoever gets those tickets. And it was Bisping's like brother-in-law. And when Dan knocked him out and then hit him after, I mean, that guy was losing it. He was going nuts, you know, screaming about how Dan's a murderer, should be suspended, you know, how he's barbaric.
Yeah. What was Dan's, what did he say?
I can't say he was wrong.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was saying. Like, what did he say after about the second shot after the KO? He's like, that'll shut him up.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, we'll shut him up a little bit. You know, so he did, And there were people I remember on the forums, and they were legitimately upset. They're like, this is going to cause the first death in the octagon, and it's going to ruin everything.
Yeah. Hey, it looked like it there for a while after that. After the leaping H-bomb, after he kissed his fist, throws the punch, knocks him out, kisses his fist, jump in the air, and lands like a hammer fist or forearm, whatever you want to call it, right to the face. Absolutely brutal.
Yeah. And, you know, that's an example of a guy. Bisping at the time was only 30. And so, he recovered after this and went on to fight a lot of big fights. But, you know, if he would have gotten knocked out like that at 36 or 37, I think that's a career ender.
Yeah. It could be. I mean, you know, that could have been the beginning of the downfall for him, really, you know, for all we know.
Yeah, I think it was. You know, if you look, go through his record, I mean, he did have some decent wins. You know, I don't know if he ever had, like, a real elite win.
Like a signature win, yeah.
I know the fight with Chael was close. Chael was number two in the world at the time. You know, but it was just like even before that fight, he had struggled a little bit with Mayhem Miller.
Yeah.
Mayhem controlled him, you know, took him down in that first round and won the first round. And then, you know, Mayhem just ran out of gas. I don't know what the hell. I think this is the beginning of the unraveling of Mayhem, which may have started well before. But so. As far as that match, I think we've said everything. But so the next fight was actually the co-main event of the evening. It was George St. Pierre, who at the time was 28 years old, and he was 18-2. He had 5 wins in a row. He had defended his belt against John Fitch and BJ Penn heading into this. Thiago Alves was actually coming off a 2008 campaign where a lot of people thought that he was the fighter of the year. He had won 7 fights in a row, not all in 2008, but he had beaten Carl Parisian, Matt Hughes, and Josh Koscheck all in 2008, all considered top 10 opponents in 2008. So GSP was a considerable favorite. But there was a lot of talk that, you know, maybe his time was coming because at the time, the Sarah knockout at UFC 69 in Houston was still somewhat fresh in people's minds. So what were your memories leading up to this co-main event of UFC 100?
Oh, yeah. This was probably the most intriguing fight as far as, you know, stylistic matchups and where I thought was going to be the best fight. Between two, you know, top level, highly skilled guys on the show, and it basically just ended up being a stinker, man. It was boring, big time. So, GSP'd him. He got him down, rode him around for a while, and got the decision.
I think it was like he just did the same thing over and over. It was a left jab and then a knee tap. Takedown, right? Yeah. Just over and over for 25 minutes.
Yeah, which is, you know, highly impressive in its own right.
It sure is, man, because Alves is a big fucking guy. I mean,
he was killing it at the time. I mean, he, you know, you're talking about he was had 7 fights in a row, but he wasn't, I mean, he was killing guys, right? He had probably, flying knees. Had he just beaten Matt Hughes recently?
Yeah, that's who he finished with the knee.
Yeah, he crushed him. So he had a lot of momentum going into that fight, but GSP shut him down. Like Onyx would say, shut him down.
And that was actually the first, because GSP had beaten BJ Penn, and you know they threw in the towel, right? So the Alves fight was the beginning of a streak where 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. GSP had 7 consecutive decision wins, starting with the Alves fight and ending with his retirement fight at UFC 167.
Yeah, well, maybe he was just trying to give the fans their money's worth.
So I got to – who has the record for the most minutes inside the octagon? Is it GSP?
It may be. I feel like I've just seen this stat recently.
Because I think people were talking about Mighty Mouse, because Mighty Mouse says, you know, every fight's a decision. But then
guys like Jim Miller, like.
Yeah.
You know.
And I don't know if you've heard, Supercalo has actually tried to give some advice to Mighty Mouse about how to better market himself. And he's now calling him Moose Johnson. So it's no more, or, you know, it first started out as Mouse Johnson. He thought that would, and then it morphed into Moose Johnson, you know, like the fullback from the early 90s Dallas Cowboys.
That was Daryl Moose Johnston, but
close enough. It's Super Callow. You know,
he's a lowly dishwasher from Mexico. So
yeah, he's a Brazilian. So I mean, he doesn't know the early 90s Dallas Cowboys.
How many different places is he from? A seasonal residence.
Well, I mean, at one point he claimed to be Chinese. Another time he claimed to be Russian. He's claiming now to be Irish. He's been in the favela. I don't know.
Hey, I love that guy.
Ben Saunders is a big fan of Supercala.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Ben Saunders.
he's from Florida, isn't he? Did he
train? Yeah, he trained with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to train with him back in the day.
So backstage, you know, you were in the stands at the time. So
yep.
What were your – is that basically all – there's not much to talk about here, right? He just took him down a lot.
Yeah, he just took him down. I think during this fight, actually, you know, I was just kind of sitting in some seats. I didn't know whose seats they were. No one was sitting in them. So Nate Diaz rolls up. He's like, "Hey man, guys are in my seats." So we move over, and I start, you know, we start talking a little bit. And I'm like, "Did you just get here?" He's like, "I've been asleep up in the room." And I'm like, "It's like this, you know, this is the fucking co-main event. Like, you were asleep in the room, and you just decided to come down now, man."
Well, who knows? Who knows what type of night he had before?
Yeah. Hey, maybe he just doesn't like watching fights. I mean, there's a lot of people that are like that. So, hey, maybe he's one of them.
Who was with him? Was his brother with him? Or
he's by himself.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was the card? I was at a card, and he put out a tweet that he couldn't get tickets.
Yeah, sometimes that happens.
Yeah, was it this one?
I don't know. Sometimes it happens. Pretty often, actually.
There was some event, man. No, you know, I think it was actually Anderson versus Weidman, the first one. He couldn't get tickets, and then some fan, like, gave him tickets, like, you know, in the rafters. But he was really happy to take them. He wanted to see the fight.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, the UFC couldn't find a ticket for him, you know. So the next fight was the main event, but not the last fight. And this, like I mentioned before, it was supposed to take place at UFC 98, Memorial Day 2009. And it was scrapped because Frank Mir injured his knee. So Lesnar versus Mir 2 was pushed back to UFC 100.
Did he really injure his knee?
Oh, I doubt it. I mean, come on. You know, I'm sure there was, there was no out of competition testing back then.
Yeah.
You know, so it was basically as long as you passed on fight night, everything was good. Then, you know, a couple weeks can make all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's suspicious, but I who the hell knows? So
I'm thinking, you know, more along the lines that they just kind of, you know, didn't take the fight so they could push it back to the big show.
To do a bigger show. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you could be right on that.
Because what was the main event of the one they pulled it off of? Evans versus Machida?
Yeah, but I don't think they were going to – I'm not sure if they were going to do a double main on 98. I can't really remember offhand. Or if that Machida-Evans fight was just thrown on there because they lost Lesnar – and Mir. Maybe they were going to do Machida and Evans at 100? No, that doesn't make sense. But, I would have to look it up. But so just to put this fight in perspective, you know, I think they had done either their regular preview show or maybe, I don't know if they did a prime time, but they went up and they filmed Brock. And you remember he broke that door at his gym because uh-huh. he got upset that they showed him a video of Mir knee-barring him. And he broke this door and he said that he comes back in and says, "Justice will be served." It's just like, oh, God. Amir is in trouble, man.
I remember one of the prime times. I don't know if it was one for that or what, but, you know, they show him eating, like, 3 cheeseburgers. You know, that's, like, his dinner. It's, like, his giant, you know, 4-patty cheeseburger and fries.
Yeah. So what was interesting about this fight was Amir decided to come in at 245 pounds, which is very light for him. I mean, he's a guy that – I mean, there was one time he would walk around 280, 285 and then cut down. So he decided to come in at 245. He thought he was going to tire Lesnar out and then win in the late rounds. I guess that was his strategy. But Lesnar just kind of ragdolled him.
Yeah. Plus, here's the thing. Has Lesnar ever really gassed out?
Never. No. I mean, I guess you could make a case he got tired against Kane, but I really think there was a – what caused – remember that pirouette he did across the cage?
Yeah, it was like a 3-minute fight.
Yeah, I think what happened there, if you slow it down, like there's like a short right hand or something that hits Lesnar, yeah. And it doesn't look like much, but I think that's what threw him for a loop. It wasn't like he was tired or anything.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I mean, remember? I mean, he was riding Heath Herring around, clowning him in the third round. He came back to beat Shane Carwin after taking a hell of a beating. And let me tell you, when you get beat up like that, you know, that takes away a lot of your cardio. So, I don't think tiring Lesnar out was even a good tactic. But maybe at that point, you know, it was kind of an unproven thing. So,
yeah, And then afterwards, Lesnar got in Mir's face.
With Couture? I mean, that fight didn't end in the first round, right?
Yeah, second round.
Yeah, so I mean, he gets better as time goes by, it seems.
Yeah. So I don't know who gave Mir that, you know, that strategy. But, I mean, after the fight, first Lesnar flips the crowd off, right?
Yep.
And then he gets in Mir's face. And I don't know what he said, but there's this famous Photoshop of Mir's face all bloodied and Brock saying, "Give me back my strawberries."
Yeah.
Have you seen that one?
Yeah. He was digging in the strawberry patch. That's a great one, yeah.
I mean, Mir's face, man, was just really – it was disfigured. I mean, Lesnar – and I could see Mir's dad's reaction right beyond the cage, and it was just like – you know, he was like, "Get him, stop the damn fight."
Yeah. I'm still, it's terrible to sit there and watch, you know, watch your son take a beating like that. But I don't know. That was a rough one. But, you know, it kind of seemed like it was going to go in that direction anyways. You know, the first time they had fought Lesnar without the stand up, he probably would have won that fight via mauling. And pretty much the second fight just followed that same pattern.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. The way the first fight unfolded with the fight getting stood up and Lesnar getting deducted the point, Lesnar was able to petition the commission so that Steve Mazzagatti would not referee the fight.
Yeah.
Which was smart because it was like, you know, I always maintained that, I don't know, maybe a couple of the punches did brush against the back of the head. But it was only because Mir was turning his head that way. It wasn't like Lesnar was like, "Oh, let me punch him in the back of the head." Mir was kind of going into the fetal position.
Yeah.
Questionable,
but
I think, you know, as they say, playing the game a little bit there. But what was interesting about this fight was I think this was the last time we saw a prime – healthy Brock Lesnar, because right after the fight, you know, they didn't give him much time because they had him booked to fight Shane Carwin I believe it was supposed to be at UFC 106, which was November of 2009, which ended up being Forrest Griffin versus Tito, the rematch.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time he had come down with a diverticulitis.
Yeah, because that fight didn't end up taking place for another year.
Yeah, he came back July 4th weekend. I think it was UFC 116, and that was against Carwin, and that was really one of the more, you know, roller coaster, you know, incredibly exciting fights. And there's that iconic view or picture of Lesnar looking across the cage at Carwin and just smiling at him like, you beat the hell out of me, man. And I'll give you that. But
there was awesome shows and moments back then. Like, you got UFC 100, you got UFC 116 with that fight. Like, that was a great show. That was a phenomenal show.
Yeah, remember Lieben and Akiyama on 116?
Yeah, another fight that was on one of the prelims, Seth Petruzzelli versus Ricardo Romero, is an awesome fight to watch. Should go watch that show. You should go watch that fight, Brian.
Yeah, you know, I hate to be one of those guys that say, oh, things were so much better in the old days.
Yeah.
But you know what? They were a lot better in the old days.
In some ways, and in some ways they aren't, you know. But the game's changing. It's never going to be like that again. So, you know, we can sit here and reminisce, and, you know, hopefully the people in the future or people that are just getting into MMA can look back at, you know, UFC 100 and learn from it and see it as a big-time historical event and, you know, try to have their own big-time memories and UFC 100s in the future.
Yeah, let's hope that there's going to be events like that. Maybe this one coming up, UFC 189 with McGregor and Aldo and Rory Mack versus Robbie Lawler. Maybe that'll become an all-time epic fight. But, you know, to me, I know McGregor's a great character. There was nobody quite like Brock Lesnar. And just below him, Chuck Liddell just had this... When Chuck was in his prime, there was just something really cool. I think he was the first real American MMA superstar.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, and at the same time, you also had, you know, Rashad Evans coming off the Ultimate Fighter. You had Forrest Griffin was at the height of his popularity. You also had, you know, Machida was undefeated at the time.
Yeah.
So he was like still a riddle that no one had even figured out or even come close to figuring out. So there's a lot of interesting characters back then. And these guys, you know, they got a little bit more time to shine too because there weren't as many fighters under contract.
And you had a prime BJ Penn back then.
Yeah, yeah, who incidentally fought Machida.
And even Randy was fighting. Randy at UFC 105 fought Brandon Vera. And, you know, truth be told, Vera got robbed. But, you know, I'm kind of happy they gave it to Randy because Vera, to me, was always frustrating to watch. A lot of talk, you know, no results.
Damn. Don't sugarcoat it.
Well, I mean, come on, man. He comes in there. He says, I'm gonna win the lightweight, the light heavyweight belt and the heavyweight belt. And they offer him a pile of money. And then what's his signature win? I mean, I don't think he beat Jardine.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. What is his signature win? Frank Mir?
Frank Mir, have you?
Yeah.
I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, you know, in all fairness to Vera, he did beat Randy. I thought that was kind of a bullshit decision at UFC 105 in the UK. Maybe in Nottingham. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah, I believe so. I think you're right.
Yeah, so... Do you have any other thoughts on Lesnar and Mir Part 2?
No, not really. I mean, I just remember it was a big time thing at the time. And you know, one thing that we haven't touched on was the Brock Lesnar promo.
Oh yeah,
after the fight, how have you skipped that, Brian?
Yeah, because that was. I guess I don't think some people get it. You know, like when I'm on Twitter, I'm always talking about Coors Light. You know, the origin of that is the Brock Lesnar promo. Because apparently he had some kind of handshake agreement that part of his new contract that he signed before UFC 100 was he was going to get a sponsorship from Bud Light. And for whatever reason, it didn't happen. Or the figure that they came to him with, he was like, no, I'm not taking your sponsorship, you know, for peanuts. And man, it pissed him off.
Yeah, I think it, man, I could be wrong, but it also could have been something along the lines of he was going to have the Bud Light sponsorship, and then all of a sudden they were just sponsoring the UFC.
Maybe that's what it was, because I think the dollar figure they were throwing around was $20 million a year Bud Light would pay the UFC, and you know they probably pay a lot more now, but at the time that was considered, it might have been their biggest sponsorship.
Yeah.
And so Lesnar comes through the curtain and gets dressed down by Uncle Dana about going on about, you know, I don't think he cared about, you know, hopping on top of his wife. I don't think that really offended anybody. But the
it probably offended Mark Merrow.
The Wild Man Mark Merrow, Johnny B. Bat.
He's a nice guy, I know.
Doesn't he have some kind of gym in Altamont Springs?
Well, I don't know exactly what the deal with that is, but I've run into him a few times through Seth, and you know, he's a really nice guy.
Yeah, so at the press conference, Brock prominently displayed right in front of him is a Bud Light.
Yeah.
And they must have threatened him something terrible, because he doesn't seem the type to me to play ball.
Yeah, yeah, they probably really laid the law down on him. But, yeah, he's going to go climb on top of his wife and then drink some Coors Light because Bud Light won't pay him nothing. It was great. But probably one of the top five MMA promos of all time.
But we're forgetting the other really good one. He said that Mir had a lucky horseshoe stuck up his ass, and he pulled that son of a bitch out and beat him over the head with it.
That's right.
I mean,
why does he have a lucky horseshoe up his ass? I don't get that.
I asked some people. Apparently, that's an old expression. Maybe it's like in Minnesota, South Dakota. That's kind of like a normal expression.
It sounds like an unlucky horseshoe to me.
I had never heard anything about a lucky horseshoe up someone's ass, but I guess I had heard of a lucky horseshoe, but maybe Brock just made it up.
I had heard of a lucky horseshoe, and I had also heard of sticking something up someone's ass, but
so Brock
combined.
So Brock just put it together, and I think because
what an innovator.
Yeah, and you know, that was the last time it was really Brock unleashed, because you remember when he beat Shane Carwin, I can see Marty Morgan telling him, calm down, calm down. You know, because he jumped on top of the cage and then started punching his chin, I guess, you know, telling the fans that he had a good chin. And
yeah, well, Marty Morgan was probably worried he was going to knock himself out.
Well, you know, I mean, his chin was never the problem, right? It was, the problem was he was afraid of getting hit.
Yeah, it was his reaction. It wasn't that he was getting knocked out. It was that he would turtle up.
I mean, you remember UFC 116. I mean, the uppercut, the left uppercut from Carwin, you slow it down. That was a glancing blow. It didn't do anything to Lesnar. And he rolled up into the fetal position against the cage. It was just like, what are you doing, man? It didn't even touch you.
It was all a rope-a-dope strategy.
Well, apparently it worked. And he has the legendary Josh Rosenthal to thank, because I think there was quite a few referees who would have stopped the fight.
Yeah. Well, Josh Rosenthal, his, I guess, sorry there, ahem, my bad. My guess is that his physical skills were kind of impaired at the time. You know, perhaps he was under the influence of marijuana. He was moving slower than he normally does.
I had heard he's out. He's in some kind of halfway house. He's out of jail.
Oh! I thought you meant of the closet at first.
No! I wouldn't.
I don't think he's in the closet either. I think he's probably straight. Although he just did get out of prison, so perhaps. Perhaps he's now, you know, batting for the other team.
You think he was humbled old country way? I mean, he could take care of himself, isn't he? A black belt.
Yeah, but hey, I really, you know, I got to figure out how we went from UFC 100 to Josh Rosenthal's sexuality. So
you actually brought that up.
Yeah, I know. Let's move on to the real main event, the headliner of UFC 100.
The people's main event?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was in the crowd at this event, and dude, I mean, I took off. I didn't give a shit about Fitch versus Paulo Thiago, who's undefeated at the time.
But I'm pretty sure they left too.
Yeah. But you know, a lot of people stayed. It was like 90% of the people stayed.
No way.
You think I'm exaggerating?
I was in the crowd. I think I left. I don't think I stayed. Maybe I stayed right till the very end, but there was people gone halfway through that fight at least.
Yeah, well, maybe you're right about that. I mean, that was a pretty shitty. I mean, I just remember it was Fitch taking him down. I mean, just to give you some context here, Fitch, 31 years old at the time, coming into the fight, 19-3. Paulo Thiago was 28, and he was 11-0 coming off a knockout win over Josh Koscheck at UFC 95 in the UK. So, you know, Fitch, he had the prior year at UFC 87, he had lost to GSP in his title fight. Then he gets fired from the UFC. A lot of people don't remember this. But in 2008, late 2008, he gets fired along with Cain Velasquez and Mike Swick, was it?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
For not signing away rights to their likeness for the upcoming video game, Undisputed by THQ Games, which went bankrupt, and I think they still owe WWE a ton of money. But yeah,
they went bankrupt because they didn't have John Fitch in the game.
No, but John Fitch finally relented, and I think he's in the game because they brought him back, and then he fought Akihiro Gono.
Yeah,
and then this fight. So you got Fitch. I think they just put him against Thiago because it was just like, yeah, he's undefeated, and we really don't have any plans for the guy. And at that point, I think they were like, okay, we got everything we can get out of Fitch. We don't want him near the belt anymore.
Yeah. That fight sucked anyways.
Yeah, I mean, Thiago had him in some pretty – it looked like some deep guillotines. But Fitch, at that time, I give the guy credit. There was a time there where Fitch – nobody could submit him. I mean, the talk with the guys was he was unsubmittable and you couldn't knock him out.
Yeah.
I think he was only knocked out maybe one time prior to that, and that was like against Wilson Gouveia, second fight or something.
Yeah, that was down in Florida.
So, I mean, Fitch, you know, people look at Fitch now and, you know, he's part of that lawsuit thing, and, you know, he was so fucking gimmicked up in that World Series of Fighting, his last fight, and he got caught for elevated levels of testosterone, which it was so fucking obvious he was on something. I mean, he had these superstar Billy Graham muscles, you know, that just kind of appeared overnight when he was 37 years old. But, I mean, you know, going back to John Fitch's glory days, man, you got to give the guy all the credit in the world because there was no doubt for a 2-3 year period, he was the second best welterweight in the world.
Oh, yeah. You could not get – I mean, you could not get by him to get the GSP. You know, that was one of the problems is John Fitch was going to beat pretty much everybody else on the way up. So it was tough, you know, to book him in fights and also tough to get some challengers.
Yeah. So, you know, that's our kind of our look back at UFC 100. You know, I kind of had a you know, it's an interesting thing. Like I said, it was – kind of ripped off the Laps fan, which is on WrestleZone.
Hey, I got a little story about John Jones I want to share from that.
Oh, you got another story? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So in retrospect, this is pretty funny. But, you know, I'm in the locker room after the fights, and they haven't announced the winner of the submission of the night. And there was three submissions that night, right, Brian? There was Shannon Guggerty got a guillotine. Tom Lawler got a guillotine. And John Jones got a guillotine. So none of us had any clue who was going to win. They hadn't announced it yet. So John and I are in the back and we're talking. And he's like, hey, you know, what are you going to do if you win that money?
And I was like, oh, man, for sure, I'm going to go buy an Escalade. I'm going to pimp it out with rims and TVs and a stripper pole and all this stuff. And I'm like, what about you, man? And he's like, well, you know, I have kids, so I could really use the money to put them through college and start a college fund. And I was just like, oh, man, I feel so bad. And then, because then they announced me as the winner. And I was like, oh, poor guy. But, you know, in retrospect, I'm damn happy that I won that money.
Yeah, so did you have to politic a little bit? Because I know there's been stories, you know, guys will have their managers go politic to Joe Silva. And what happened?
For that one, no. I mean, I didn't talk to any.
Oh, the dog's back.
Oh, yeah. Back and better than ever.
The dogs are in the back. The gate is locked. Is that what he said? Benoit?
Whatever. Okay, so yeah, no, nobody. I didn't talk to anybody. It just so happened they picked me. I found out by seeing it on TV.
Were you just like, oh my god? I mean, because that's career changing, life changing money for a. Because back,
like, got like queasy. You know, I got dizzy, kind of. It could have been the drinks too, but
I'm sure it was. So I'm looking up here. Yeah, man. So they had you on that tough contract. So you were making 8 and 8.
Yep.
Wow. So that 100,000, that was just, you must have just been like, you got to be, you know, because you were 26 years old back then.
Yeah. It was a game changer. I wiped my ass with a $100 bill. Have we talked about this?
No. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah. Well, no, I just took I figured if I'm ever going to do this, now's the time. So I took a $100 bill and wiped my ass with it. And then I cleaned it off and used it again later. But
who ended up getting that $100 bill?
Well, I can't remember. I mean, I just used it to buy something.
Well, that's what I'm worried about. That seemed very inconsiderate. And I mean, God only knows what types of diseases can be found in your fecal matter.
No, I don't know. I honestly, I don't remember what I did with that. I just remember that I did, in fact, do that.
Well, just to wrap here a little bit, that was kind of our, you know, our look back on some of the. I guess we'll do this regularly. It seemed kind of fun to kind of take a stroll down memory lane about a major event in UFC history and MMA history, rather. What do you think, Tom?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. So we could brainstorm, find another one, and then go through it again. And yeah. We didn't even talk about how well this did on pay-per-view, historically.
Yeah, well, it's still the standard bearer for MMA pay-per-view. At, you know, Dave Meltzer reported 1.6 million buys. Kevin Ioli has been citing 1.25 million buys. I really don't know which one is right. But it's the biggest show they ever did.
Yeah. Yeah, and it had a lot of hype behind it. And, you know, it's interesting we do this on the day after Mayweather-Pacquiao. And this was kind of, up to now, probably MMA's Mayweather-Pacquiao.
Yeah. I mean, and then the week before that, you had Mighty Mouse versus Horiguchi. So, you know, Mayweather-Pacquiao was the Horiguchi, Mighty Mouse of boxing.
Yeah. The two best. And actually, the Kentucky Derby was the Mighty Mouse and Horiguchi of horse racing, because they're all the same size.
Oh, man. You know, I think Dave Schaller, VP of Public Relations for the UFC, I think he got a little mad at me on Twitter because I told Schaller that Super Callow and I saved his job because they didn't promote Japanese Fedor.
Yeah, Horiguchi.
The great Horiguchi. He'll be back, man. He's only 24 years old. Yeah. I'm sure he'll stake his claim as the greatest flyweight in MMA history.
We'll see.
Other than El Torito and Hornswoggle.
We'll see. Until they can produce something as entertaining as a WLC match, I'm going to hold my breath.
All right, man. All right. So that's what we got for you. I guess send us some ideas of the events. You know, I guess we could do, you know, the 2002 Shockwave event kind of really intrigued me, but I don't know if I can find it anywhere online. Is that on Fight Pass, or does somebody else own the rights to that?
If it's not, I'll be able to find it.
Because Shockwave, I mean, I know they say there was 90,000, but I mean, I don't think there was. But it was some Japanese baseball stadium, and let me just run off the cards. Let's see here. Okay, so they say 91,107 at Tokyo National Stadium, with the main event being Mirko Krokop versus Sakuraba.
Yeah.
And then also the legendary Big Nog versus Bob Sapp match was on there too.
Yep.
So that would be an interesting one. So, or even Affliction, you know, because there's a lot of historical things related to Affliction. That was a cool time to be a fan, man. Back in 2008, there was a lot of things going on.
Yeah, we could also check out like King of the Cage, Desert Heat.
Who was on that? Was Rampage on that? Or
I don't know. I don't
know. But you know, the event that I'm most proud of, and like, you know, maybe in 20 or 30 years, I'll be able to show them the ticket stub and say, hey, you know, I got credibility as a hardcore fan. April 2008, I went to the Yama pit fighting event in Atlantic City.
That is impressive.
I mean, it was Scotty Farrell was the ring announcer. And I'm sitting next to this guy who is just
the sportscaster?
Yeah, the sportscaster. You know, the guy is like, Scotty Farrell.
Yeah, I was on his show. He was a show on Howard Stern's network, right?
Yeah, Howard 101, yeah.
Yeah, I was on his show once. Oh. They said he requested me.
Really?
Like from the press, yeah. Like he requested me out of all the people.
Well, I mean, the guy wasn't an expert on MMA, but I mean, shit, he watched MMA a lot more than, you know, guys that have national TV shows. I mean, you know, Howard 101, prior to that, he was on some major, he was on like national, like Westwood One with CBS. But I mean, I think they caught him doing a bunch of coke, like right before the show. And it was a big fucking disaster for him. But I know that's shocking that you would think Scotty Farrell would be using a substance such as that.
Yeah, no way.
Yeah, so Scotty Farrell, remember backstage? Him and Chuck Zito at Affliction 1 were handling the backstage interviews.
Yeah, that's insane.
Oh, man. All right, so that's it for this weekend. And you'll be hearing from us. Oh, and I want to remind people that on WrestlingObserver.com, Tom has a new show with Brian Alvarez. I don't know if it's called Figure Four Daily or is it the Tom Lawler show with Brian Alvarez?
No, it's Figure Four Daily. But I was thinking today that, I mean, to be honest, the Figure Four is kind of like an outdated move. So I'm going to push for something like maybe the Sharpshooter Daily or, you know, maybe the Yes Lock Daily. Switch it up. You know, the Figure Four, that's been around for ages and ages. And, you know, we need to move out of the Stone Age here.
Sister Abigail Daly.
Oh, please no.
Yeah, that's not a great move, is it?
Oh, my God, it's terrible.
How about Hell's Gate?
That is the worst move. I don't even want to continue this conversation any longer.
Well, anyway, you really should. I mean, if you're listening to this, you really should subscribe to Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez's website, WrestlingObserver.com. I've been subscribing to that newsletter since I was about 10 years old, so over 20 years.
Yeah. You know what's actually crazy is I'm probably one of the few people, I may have mentioned this before, is like I used to pirate their stuff. And then I thought like, wait a minute. Like, well, this wasn't going on for a long time, like a week or two. You know, and I was like, I really enjoy listening to this. And I went and, you know, searched it out to buy it. So, all those people that say that free MP3s and free music, you know, leads to more sales. I mean, in this case, they were right as far as it goes for me and that. So, you know, it's a quality product when you can get it for free, you know how to find it for free and you still go and pay for it. So,
Yeah, and I think it, what is it, $10 a month?
Yeah, well, I think you know, a yearly subscription maybe knocks it down to like $9.99, and I think maybe it's $10.99 otherwise. But
yeah, so
awesome source.
So you get the Wrestling Observer newsletter, you get Brian Alvarez's newsletter, all the radio shows, and Dave's subscription board, the board as they call it. And Dave, you know, he'll just appear out of nowhere and Dave somebody, which is kind of like. Like when somebody's talking like bullshit and they're totally wrong on something, Dave will come in there and like give them the lowdown and just totally humble them. And then like someone will come in and put Daved. Yeah. It's like
we're really sounding like internet nerds now, Brian.
Ah, fuck them. Who cares? All right, Tom. Hey, good talking to you again. And we'll talk this week and figure out what we're doing for next week.
All right. Sounds good, man.
Later, buddy.
Peace.